After 3 years of hearings and arguments, testimony and challenges, the trial of Arturo Juarez Suarez, who stands accused of the murder of the Martinez family and the rape and assault of Yolanda Martinez, is ready to begin. Once again, Yolanda will face the man who raped her, murdered her family, and buried her children alive, seeking justice for those Suarez stole. On this episode of California True Crime, Arturo Juarez Suarez and the Martinez Family Murders, Part 4. Welcome back to our fourth episode on the Martinez family murders and the trial of Arturo Juarez Suarez. As with the last three, I'm Charles, and I'll be leading us through this last portion of this case that deals with the actual hearing, the verdicts, and some aftermath for not only the victims' families, but the local communities, and really the state at large. With me, as always, are Jessica and Sean. How are you guys doing?
I'm doing good.
Me too.
So do either of you have any questions or I know this has been a particularly hard one for us to go over. Thoughts about it since we last talked about this case?
I'm glad that it's finally getting to the trial. It was a lot to figure out with the defense attorney keep throwing things out there, but it was interesting to learn the process because I don't think we really went, when we have preliminaries, we don't have that in depth of a process before. So I feel like that was pretty good to learn.
And I think that's why I really enjoyed that writing of it and the research of it was because oftentimes we talk about, oh, there's a preliminary hearing and we know that oftentimes things are put back. And it really strikes me back to when we did the research on Dorothy Puente's case about all of the intricacies about moving that trial and how much it costs and this and that. And I owe all of that to the reporters from the Sacramento Bee and the Placer County newspapers, because those are the people that are in the courts every day. And they really did an excellent job of detailing what went on and was kind of our window into that process, and did an excellent job where a lot of, by this point in it, unfortunately, a lot of other major news sources around the state and outside of California stopped covering this case by this point. You know, we're 3 years in now at this point. But I will say that the area newspapers and the local communities that have not only tried to help and support Yolanda and her family, but really made it a point so that this case would not be forgotten. I will say that it's no longer front coverage news. You did have to go to the metro, the local sections to get this. They were still covering in a lot of detail. We do want to issue a listener advisory. There will be some details in this as well as our other episodes. But if you are listening with younger listeners or stories of rape and murder, especially when it deals with children, is not something that you want to listen to, we understand. You might want to skip this episode and then come back for our next episode. Just a real quick recap. We had talked about in our last episode, we talked about preliminary hearings leading up to, and as we talked about in the opening, we've had questions about translators. We've had questions about the confession. We've had translators about an international treaty from 1968 be thrown out by the judge, but been brought up by the defense. We've had gag orders. We've had emotional outbursts by the victim, Yolanda, in front of the court that brought the courtroom to tears. But we are finally at the actual trial. No more pushing it off, no more delays. Jury has been selected and the trial date has been set. So in February of 2001, the defense opening statement will state that Suarez, quote, just snaps. They will go on to say that Suarez took complete responsibility for everything that he had done shortly after his arrest, and we, as his attorneys, will respect that, unquote. which means saying, hey, we are not advising him to plead this. We're saying that he just snapped. They will not offer anything in the way of a motive or a why to the reason that he did this. He just simply snapped, and they leave it at that. They will say that there are legal issues that need to be resolved in this case, and that is why a trial is important. It seems that they're really talking about the death penalty case and whether or not Suarez is to be put to death for his crimes. Now, I usually go over prosecution always presents their case first. The reason why I go over the defense first is because the defense has done a lot of legal maneuvers to make sure this is done the right way. And he initially did enter a plea of innocent, but now in their opening statement, the defense says, yeah, he's guilty. But I won't say they completely say it's by reason of insanity, but they're trying to give the jury reasons why not to give him the death penalty. The prosecution, which is led by Deputy DA Thomas Beattie, will cite testimony by the surviving victim, multiple admissions by the defendant, and physical evidence all tying Suarez to the crime, and that really demonstrates the strength of the state's case. For the prosecution, in March, Yolanda will take the stand again. Yolanda Martinez will take the stand again to testify, although this time it is a much different testimony than last time. I don't mean in what she talks about, because again, she goes into graphic detail and explains exactly what happens, how her children scream for Suarez to stop while he's beating and attacking her. Though this time she does it with a quiet restraint that I think is, this is not just me saying, this is the newspaper saying, that carries as much weight and power as her emotional outburst in the first preliminary hearing. And again, you know, she's lived with this for 3 years, and this not knowing what's going to happen. I just the fact that, again, she has to testify about the worst possible thing that can happen is a testament to how amazingly strong and resilient she is.
And hopefully this time they've given her some preparation for the trial.
I think so. I will say that the DA's office has done everything. It seems like from what has been reported in the newspapers, the DA's office is really, it's not like they've parked her in a corner and not talking to her. They've talked to her. She has her own lawyer. I think who's we've talked about him before, Michael Constantine. He's been with her every step of the way. She now has the emotional support of her sister and her sister's husband there. She has family. Galt, the entire town has done, as much as they can to help. So I think she's probably in a better place than she was. Not that you're ever going to be in a perfect place after what happened to her, but I think, yeah, she's probably emotionally more ready for what's coming. The defense will bring up that the family was close at one time and that Suarez was constantly doing favors and helping out, including signing paperwork to help the loan for the Martinez's new business, as well as letting them stay with him from time to time at the ranch. And again, this is the way it's reported in the newspaper. Yolanda has testimony about the attack and the rape and the murder and everything that's going on. And the defense kind of comes back with, well, yeah, but weren't you guys close? Didn't he do favors for you? Didn't Suarez sign the loan papers so that Jose and Juan could start their business? Like it's some kind of, I won't say justification, but like that explains something. And it doesn't. A note about the jury. The jury is made up of 8 women and 4 men with 3 alternates. All of them went to the crime scene with the lawyers and the judge from Napa to Auburn. So remember we said the court is in Napa. It's moved there. And so on word of the judge, everyone piles into buses actually and travel. I find it odd that the ranch is located actually off of Mount Vernon Road. The jury, along with a bailiff, made up a trip on wine tour buses. So again, if you're familiar, Napa is wine country. The court, to get these people moved from point A to point B, they actually get local wine tour buses. Now, that doesn't mean they were drinking wine and having a tour, but it's the quickest conveyance they could get from point A to point B. They are not permitted any discussion at all with each other, with anyone there. They were taken off the bus. They were taken on a tour of the entire ranch as far as the trailer, the grave, where Yolanda was at the house, and then the barn and the place where the 911 call was made. They were allowed to submit questions that would then be reviewed and answered at a later time. So they're all taking notes. At the end of the day, they submit all of their questions to the bailiffs. The lawyers and the judge look at those questions and then answer them, I guess, like a day later. So we get to the defense case. The defense will make the case that the confession was not accurate because of the translator. So they'll bring that up, even though we've had two hearings on the translation and the translation stands. The court records will show that his story will change a few times, especially when he gets caught in a lie. So I think that's an interesting tactic because they're saying, well, the translation is not accurate. You can tell it's not so accurate because look, his story changes. But the prosecution will say, yeah, his story changes because we caught him in a lie. And that's why his story is changing. But this would be unsuccessful since it had already been ruled on in the previous hearing. So even though the defense says, yeah, that's it, it's kind of shot down almost immediately.
I find it interesting that they even allowed him to talk about it. Because it seems like that was the whole point. You have a trial to say that it should be not there because it's bad translation, but to still bring it up.
Well, and the only thing I could think of in that case is the hearing was to see if that would even be allowed in the case, the actual transcripts and the record. There's nothing saying he can't bring it up to throw shade on that so that the jury might have a second thought about it. And it seems like from the reporting from the courtroom that this is not a line of argument that's lasted very long. The defense brings it up, and it's like I said, it's almost immediately shot down by the DA and the judge. Like, no, it stands. Move on. The defense would cross-examine some of the witnesses about Suarez's demeanor after July 12th and his complaints of headaches, sleeplessness, and nervousness. The defense would also attack the claim of rape by questioning Detective Diana Stewart about the fact that on the day of the attack and murder, when interviewed, Yolanda had not been sure if she had seen Suarez's penis or not because she had been beaten so bad and was in and out of consciousness.
I don't even have words for that. That's disgusting that they would. He beat her. So like you're saying, she was in and out of consciousness, which is also not her fault that she didn't see that. But also, I don't know why that would be a necessity for saying someone was raped. I mean, you don't have to see those things in order to be raped.
No, they have a medical examiner. They have a rape examiner that has evidence saying that she was raped. And then to put her through this, because they're not attacking her. I won't say they are attacking her. But they're doing it in such an underhanded way. They're attacking the police detective who took the report while Yolanda is in the courtroom. Like, you weren't really raped. Like, it's just so disgusting. Again, it's victim blaming.
Is this headache, sleeplessness, and nervousness thing comes up lots. He says it. He goes to the doctor. He says it at his interrogations. Is there anything that comes about? Do you think he might have thought this could be a defense? Is this when the Ambien murders, or not murders, but the weird things that Ambien could do? Like, is he using it as a scapegoat?
I honestly don't know. I think he says it so many times that I do believe that he, and again, understand this is complete conjecture on my part. There is some reporting in the news sources and the media, and the court records make note of it, but it's not necessarily called out specifically. But I do think that this is his way of trying to explain, I did this because. Now, I think his defense are latching on to that because as they say in their opening statement, there's confessions. We're, you know, in not to put too fine a point on it, we're just trying to keep the guy from the death penalty. We're trying to keep him from the gas chamber.
It just does seem weird that it keeps getting brought up. So I just wasn't, or even just those weird things of maybe it makes himself feel better.
And it might. But I also find it weird that there's no other evidence. Like, there's no doctor's reports. There's no, like, he says it as like, it's almost like a little kid making excuses for doing something bad. Like, you don't have any other proof. You have headaches and sleeplessness, cool. What do you have, a doctor's appointment? Do you have medical records? Do you have anything else to prove that there was a reason? Were you examined by a doctor now? Like, they have all of these experts going into him, but I don't see anywhere that the defense says this is the reason. Oh, look, he has encephalitis?
Encephalitis.
You have, you know, yeah, migraines, chronic migraines. You have brain fever. I don't know anything that would point to a reason why this terrible event was caused by headaches or sleeplessness. Otherwise, it just comes off as you're trying to make excuses and get away with something. So online with the defense questioning the rape, the defense will actually call a pathologist who testifies that the injuries that she sustained during the rape to her vagina could have been caused by hands or fingers, and it was inconclusive whether the penetration had actually occurred. Remember, this is all being done in court in front of the victim and through an interpreter.
I'm as mad as you are, Jessica, but I'm just wondering right now, it's like, what is this? Is this, would this lessen the charge from rape to sexual assault?
At this point, I don't, it's not, they're not going to change the charge. I think if I had to guess, I would say they're trying to poke holes in the narrative that the prosecution has put forward to call into doubt how the evidence is interpreted. So again, they're trying to give the jury an out. They're trying to give them, look, this all is not exactly the way that the prosecution has laid out, so it's not worth killing our client for. Life without possibility of parole or, you know, 60 years in prison or whatever. But I think at this point, the defense really are trying to keep him out of the death chamber.
Yeah, the defense seems to be on a slippery slope of being a good defense attorney or just being a horrible human right now, I feel like.
Well, and again, I think this is another instance of, and I know I've said it quite a bit over the course of these four episodes, but I'll keep continuing saying it, is I really was impressed by the reporting out of like the Sacramento Bee when they're reporting this. It's not said this kind of stuff, because I can see some of the stuff being reported as kind of salacious. And we've talked about in some of the other cases where some of the details of the case and the testimony are reported in kind of a salacious and titillating way to, you know, to get that readership. I think this is done almost as a way of like a factor, like this is messed up. Like, this is what they're doing. Like, can you believe this? Because these are people that have been with the case, you know, in this case, some of these reporters have been reporting on this case for 3 years. Mm-hmm. And they've been, you know, and just that image of, here's a woman who has had the worst possible things happen to her, sitting in a courtroom, again, bravely staring down the person that did them to her, and then has to hear that the pathologist is being questioned about whether she was actually raped or not through a translator is just, it's ugly.
I would think, like Sean's saying, it would almost have, in this kind of case where there are all these other crimes on, you know, on top of that, you risk making the jury feel more angry about the way you're handling the case. I mean, I don't understand, but I get in other cases where there's just the rape is just the rape charge.
Right.
You're trying to take apart what is it, what isn't, you know, and I may not like that, but I can understand why a defense attorney does it. But in this, where there's all these, there's murder charges on top of that, I would think this would really sway me. I would just have a hard time sitting in this courtroom as a juror.
And I'm not trying to rate which is worse, but like you said, you have such a fine point on the rape charge. And it goes back to the weird thing of like, well, I'll admit to killing two kids, but I won't admit to the rape. That is weird to me. And then the idea of like, we're so focused on this point, we're going to kind of ignore the fact that he killed two small children,
yeah,
and then executed two adults.
Unless the rape is part of the special circumstance that they're using in order to get the death penalty.
Well, it is. Some of the special circumstances are. One of them is, and now I'm losing. We recorded this before, but it's one of the special circumstances is rape, and with like kidnapping with the intent to rape. And so I will say, if they can get that special circumstances, that knocks that, has a potential to knock that less. But, and again, understand we are not law experts. This is our kind of our discussion and conjecture on this. And if you are listening to this and understand how that would change a jury's opinion, you can always email us at calitruecrime@gmail.com.
You love role-playing, science fiction, and history. What if there was a podcast that brought all these things you love together in a deep, dramatic experience you'll never forget? Enter The Twilight Histories, a campaign-style storytelling podcast that casts you as the hero. With The Twilight Histories, you will travel to exotic worlds spread across the multiverse. Some are familiar, others are totally exotic. You'll visit Egypt locked in an ice age. You'll follow Napoleon into India. You'll explore Venus terraformed by dinosaurs. Choose your adventure and experience a world out of time. The Twilight Histories was awarded Apple's Best of 2019. Listen to The Twilight Histories wherever you find your podcasts. Now, step on the platform and let's get you on your way.
During his defense, Suarez's family background will be brought up. His mother, Arias Suarez Aguiar, and his father, Tomas Suarez Gonzalez, would have 10 children and live in Santa Gertrudez, Mexico. One of the children, Abundo, would die in an unspecified accident. The family was poor, slept in the same room, and had no running water of any kind. It was reported that, at times, there would be no food and his parents would not be able to take the children to the doctor or dentist, even when they had the measles. Suarez would begin to work around 10 years of age and give the money that he had earned to his family. Eventually, when he came to the United States, he would still send money home to his family. Again, to me, this is the defense trying to spin a narrative that Suarez was really, in the past, not that bad a person. His mother actually would testify on the stand that Tomas Suarez would drink almost every day until about 10 years ago. This led to an abusive household. He would verbally assault the children, but not physical violence towards the children. This was not the case, however, with Maria. Benjamin Suarez's brother, would testify to the abuse that the children had suffered and witnessed as their father drank and hit their mother. So, it's this image of this alcoholic, verbally and emotionally abusive father who may not hit the kids, but is hitting the wife. The money that was raised was used on alcohol for Tomas. So the whole family says all that money that came into the family went into drinking. Other siblings would also testify as well, all recounting the same kind of stories of verbal abuse at the hands of an alcoholic father who was verbally abusive to them while being physically abusive to their mother. Some of these stories, though, would show slight variations where some of the physical abuse was delivered unto the children, even one case where glass from a broken, like, drinking glass was thrown at one of the children and cut her. This was also a story about how their father would go out after one of the brothers with a knife. According to a former teacher, Suarez was a diligent, polite, and extroverted student that received good grades and would eventually finish secondary school. He did not attend preparatory school because he thought it would be better to go to work and support his family. And preparatory school is like after they get done with secondary school, it's what you would get ready to go into university in Mexico for. A clinical psychologist and psychosocial and cultural expert would testify that Suarez's father brought shame to the family and which would affect the children's emotional and social development. He would go on to testify about the extreme poverty as well as the general experiences of migrant workers and how those could all affect the children as they grow up. The defense would also have a correlational consultant testify, James Easton, about the idea that Suarez would be able to adapt to the conditions of life imprisonment without parole, without posing a threat to others. While he was at the Placer County and Napa County jails, he received no disciplinary write-ups, and his security classification was reduced.
I find this interesting, that this is coming up during the trial instead of he was already found guilty.
Yeah, and I really think that has to do with when, like we said earlier, when you look at how the defense even starts their opening statements going, and we know our client's already confessed to the crimes four times. We know there's an eyewitness testimony. We know there's mountains of evidence. we just don't believe our client should be killed or should be put to death. And so I think they are playing from that standpoint of we're assuming he's going to be found guilty. So we're going to start laying the groundwork now for sentencing. I also think it's the first time I remember, at least while we've been doing this podcast, that we've ever had somebody comment about the behavior in jail of the person at a court case. Nothing comes off, you know, again, if you're listening to this and are familiar with our back catalog, and if that's the case, let us know, because I don't remember. That's what caught me was I was reading the case, and they're like, well, that's interesting that they brought up, again, like you said, Sean, he's not even sentenced yet, and they're already bringing up, he's like, let's give him life and without possibility of parole. Both sides rest in April of 2001. The prosecution's case was a total of 4 weeks of testimony with 55 witnesses and a trip to the crime scene. The defense case lasts just 2 hours. During that 2 hours, Suarez will not take the stand, and the defense will still challenge the charge of rape.
It's fascinating that 3 years goes by. They push it back, and then they only have 2 hours. And they're pretty much, it's not even a trial. It's a trial of don't kill me.
Yeah.
All this, everything, the Yolanda going through it, the money that is spent, the, you know, switching to another city, all this stuff, to have a defense case that lasts 2 hours, it's...
No, I agree with you. I expected, like, and again, some of you that listened, you know, if you listen to our podcast before, you know how kind of we do research. We look through the newspapers and gather our research materials. And I had like stacks of old newspapers, you know, clippings and stuff. And when we got to the trial, I thought, oh man, it's going to, you know, this, because at every turn, it seems like, and that's kind of how I, you know, I know Jessica, you work the similar, and I think Sean, you do too. We kind of go in order of how we find the material. And so I expected with Talman, 3 years of like roadblock, and you know, defense attorney, you know, magic. And then we get to the final thing and it's 2 hours. And this is after 4 weeks of witnesses and tours and stuff. And I will say it was kind of anticlimactic.
It seems like kind of a testament to how much, well, how clear it was who had done this perhaps, but
yes,
also how much evidence was collected and, you know, organizations working together like the FBI and Placer County and them getting, you know, a lot of their defense's hopes were on being able to discount things or not have something brought up in court as opposed to, yay, someone else did this.
I think you're 100% correct, because I think it is a big testament to the DA's office and the Placer County Sheriff's Department, the FBI, Sacramento FBI, Long Beach, at every turn, all of these agencies are working together to get justice for Yolanda and her family. And I think they want to make sure everything is done correctly and that there is no possibility this person can escape. So it's gratifying the level that they go to. I don't think it's any big surprise that Suarez will be found guilty on all 7 charges that the DA brings. 4 counts of first-degree murder, 1 count of rape, kidnapping, and sexual assault. Deliberations at the trial only took 15 hours over 4 days. I find that amazing that the deliberation took longer than the defense. The only hang-up for them was the rape charge. This was evident in the questions that were asked of the court during the deliberations. And I didn't have access to those. Those weren't reported in the newspaper. But what was reported is there were certain questions that were asked from the jury to the judge over the course of the 15 hours, over the 4 days, that really spoke to the idea that they were really hung up on this charge of rape. There were a few things that hung up on the penalty phase of the trial. One was the alternate juror had to be used as one of the main jurors, juror number 11 actually, was scheduled to go on a prepaid Paris trip, so she had to be replaced. So this juror had been there the entire time, but because it took so, you know, long or whatever, was so the judge said, yes, you're excused. The alternate came on, no problem. There were also several visa issues with witnesses that were being brought in for Suarez's family to testify on his behalf. There were 35 of them total, and they would not be able to testify until a month later. So that also delayed it slightly. So again, we've mentioned it a few times that the visa process has been so integral to this case, and that again, even at the end, even at the defense and the penalty phase, we're still having these issues. His mother will testify in the penalty phase and speak about the abuse that he suffered as a child and the good that he did for his family. His defense attorney at this point, a person by the name of Acton, will plead for her client, quote, "Give him life in prison. Please don't kill him," unquote. The jury will sentence Suarez to death and take 1.5 days to do it. Judge Snowden will state, quote, "You're not alone in this. The subject of the death penalty will come up, and I don't believe anyone that hasn't been there can express an opinion that I'm interested in," unquote. He goes on to say, quote, "One of the poignant moments of this trial was the feeling I had as I watched the 15 of you being sworn in as jurors and looked into your eyes. And I knew none of you would be the same after you completed the heavy job ahead of you. I guess there's a certain loss of innocence. That will never change. But take pride not in knowing what verdict you reached, but that you were there to give full measure for your community and society." Before we go on, I do want to just take a moment to single out what that judge said, because I think oftentimes we don't think, or I know I don't, I can only speak for myself, is I don't often think about that heavy weight that a jury has in a case like this. Yes, he's guilty. There's a mountain of evidence. But ultimately, these 15 people have the weight of putting that person to death. And I think that's a solemn responsibility that we ask our fellow citizens to do. And I really respected the idea that the judge takes a moment to acknowledge that and let them know that that the only people on the planet that understand what that is like is that other people that have sat in that exact chair. And so regardless of what happens. So I was really heartened by that. At this point, the judge will review all of the evidence and the verdict. If he agrees, it will stand and Suarez will receive the death penalty. The defense will file their appeal at this point. The prosecution will say that the case was well presented to the jury, while the defense will say Arturo, a man who was loved and respected by his family and community, suffered a mental breakdown. The trial was estimated to cost around $1 million. Plaster County would actually petition the governor the governor of California at the time, who was Gray Davis, to help with the cost. And Governor Davis actually would agree. This kind of help would bode well for other smaller counties where the cost of a capital case might have been too high and had them second-guessing whether they were going to proceed with this case. And I think this is one of those times when we talked about the ramifications for the state in large. When Placer County went to the governor and said, "We need help with this bill. We can't afford to do it. But what we did was correct and right and appropriate." And the governor said, "Yes, that is good. Let us help you." That kind of sent that clarion call out to other counties that said, "Well, maybe we can go forward with some of these cases that should be capital offenses or are bigger, higher profile cases rather than either not or putting them off or pleading down to lesser charges or what." In October, the sentence of death was upheld. The judge will say that the severity and brutality of the crime would outweigh the idea that the defense used of his life lived for others and the childhood of abuse that he may have suffered, that defense did not hold water in this case. Around the time of the sentencing, towards the tail end of the trial, the Carrie Stainer trial would start and it would heat up. And the stories of this case would be overshadowed by another tragedy that was firmly lodged in the minds of a nation glued to their TVs. At the final sentencing in November of 2001, Yolanda was given a chance to confront her attacker and the person who had murdered her family a last time before he was sentenced to death. She sat in the witness box. Quote, "I can't understand what kind of life you had had to do what you did. For all my efforts, I cannot find any sense in all of this. I still do not accept the loss of my family. I still do not understand how there could be people so evil like you, Arturo, without scruples, without conscience, without anything. They say the time will heal any wound, but I don't believe it. unquote. In talking of her children, she said, quote, I managed to see their faces desperate, full of anguish. Now the only thing I ask is that justice be done, unquote. Before passing final sentencing, Judge Snowden would say that he and everyone who observed the trial felt, quote, helpless incomprehension, unquote. He would also conclude, quote, I wish you peace, unquote. He would then lay down the sentence of 4 death sentences. Arturo Juarez Suarez is currently awaiting death in San Quentin State Prison. A few things, actually, that happened since the trial. In 2005, there's actually more trouble with a Vienna convention. As another prisoner convicted of murder and sentenced to death in Texas, arose more questions about how foreign nationals were being dealt with by United States courts. It seems there were 49 other cases where Mexican consulate was not identified, that there was somebody already in custody. Then President Bush said that all the cases were foreign nationals being held on death row would have their cases reviewed. Of the surviving victim, there's little or to no information on Yolanda's current whereabouts or how her life has continued. She eventually will return to Mexico to live with her sister and her sister's family. Jose Martinez was 37 years old, a devoted family man that loved his children, playing soccer, and helping people. He was planning to own his own business and eventually his home. Jack and Ariel were loving siblings that were always looking out for one another. They enjoyed playing outside and going to McDonald's. Juan, who was 27 at the time of his death, loved spending time with his family and traveling around California with them. Yolanda would say that learning about their deaths was like a nightmare. She felt that her life had no meaning. She felt alone and hopeless. She had to learn how to support herself without the love of her family. She would testify that she wished she could turn back time and trade her life for that of her children. The pain of not being able to protect her children when they needed her the most and knowing that they were there while she was being beaten was something that she carried with her every day. She would say that she had no plans for the future. Those had died with her family. But that she would go on with the help of God.